Kramer is also known as a musician who takes risks. Throughout his career in post-Stalinist Russia, he championed contemporary composers who were out of favor with the Soviet leadership. After emigrating to the West, Kramer became enthralled with the music of Astor Piazzolla before the tango was widely accepted in the classical repertoire. In 1996, he founded the Kramerata Baltica, a chamber orchestra made up of young musicians from three Baltic states, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Let's hear some more Happy Birthday variations from their new CD. I asked Gidon Kramer how he put the chamber orchestra together.
It was just a couple of weeks before I celebrated my 50th birthday, and I had this idea to give myself a present by organizing an orchestra, but I intended to assemble the musicians only for a summertime for the 1997 festival in Lockenhaus, a festival which I do run now already for 22 years. So around my 50th birthday, I wanted to assemble musicians from the countries I was in my youth the closest to, since I am a native of Latvia. But once I got to know these people, once I started to work with them, it became evident to me that I can't part from them, and I just want to maintain this wonderful atmosphere of cooperating with these musicians.
Now, you were born in 1947 in Riga, Latvia, and your parents were both violinists. Also your grandfather, right?
That's correct.
Did they all play in the state orchestra?
My grandfather was a professor at the Academy of Music in Riga, and both my parents played in a national radio orchestra. My mother worked there for 27 years as a violinist.
And your mother spoke German, your grandfather was Swedish, and your father was a Baltic Jew. So
exactly.
It's really a very mixed ethnicity. Did you fit in?
Yeah, recently I had to think about my father, because seeing the movie The Pianist by Roman Polanski, such a strong and striking movie, which impressed me a lot, as probably everyone that is going to see it. I had to think about my father because, in fact, the story, the plot of the movie is exactly the story of my father, who escaped and survived the ghetto in Riga, where 35 relatives of his were killed, including his wife and his little daughter.
How did he survive? People hid him? He hid in apartments? He hid in... in
cellars? Yeah, he hid in cellars in an apartment, which one a Latvian lady, not an apartment, but in a little back room of an apartment, which a Latvian lady gave him to hide in cellars. But he did hide for 2 years, and I think now I can much better understand what it meant to him.
So how early did they begin to groom you as a part of the family violin dynasty?
In fact, I started to play violin when I was 4.5 years old, and I'm still playing it.
That sounds as if there were must have been a lot of pressures, a lot of dreams that your parents had that they invested in you.
For sure. I even wrote in my book called Splinters of Childhood, I wrote about the pressures of my encounters with my father, for whom I became his second life, because after such a tragedy that happened to him, he still had the ambition and the patience to make his son a musician.
You studied at the Moscow Conservatory, and this is in the 60s and the 70s. That's post-Stalinist Soviet Union, and it was really very bleak times economically and politically. What were your circumstances as a music student? What was that time like for you?
It's very difficult for me to answer it in few words, but it was a tough time in Moscow. You had to be very careful what you play, what you say, with whom you associate, who are your friends. And I rather early understood that I can't give in to all the expectations of a governmental system, that I want to live my own life and I want to choose myself what to do, what to play, with whom to be friends. And so pretty easy and pretty soon I got into conflicts with the state system.
Can you give me an example?
As a result of this conflict, I didn't belong for many years to the to those artists who were sent as representatives of the country, as representatives of the Soviet Union abroad. Even more, I was literally stopped from traveling for many years abroad. I was not allowed to go to foreign countries, except in the very beginning when I succeeded to win certain competitions. But after I won my main competition and a very recognized competition, the Tchaikovsky competition, 1970, after that, for a number of years, I was not allowed to travel at all, except within the Soviet Union itself.
What then did music mean for you during that time? Was it a safe place to express yourself and your individuality or the tensions that you were suffering from? Or did you always feel that music was subjected to these political and these conformist pressures and that there was tension there also?
I always felt like the music was subjected to this tensions and to this pressure, but at the same time, I did fight for my own freedom, and I still, already at that time when I was not allowed to travel, enlarged immensely my repertoire and got associated with people that I valued a lot, like Alfred Schnittke, Arvo Pärt, Sofia Gubaidulina, Edison Denisov, all those composers who did work, live under the same pressure as all of us.
Throughout your career, you've championed the music of Alfred Schnittke, and he was not considered acceptable in the time that you were playing him in the Soviet Union. Can you tell us about him and what drew you to his music?
I was lucky to be befriended with Alfred Schnittke. He was my friend for almost 30 years. Unfortunately, he passed away now already 5 years ago. One should not forget that the 70s were not the 70s were not the same time as the 30s or the 50s in the Soviet Union. Nobody was killed or put into a labor camp for not conforming to the regime, not writing political music, music of socialist realism as the regime maybe wanted. But still, hindrances for performances existed, and most of the composers, like Alfred Schnittke, Sofia Gubaidulina, Edison Denisov, Valentin Silvestrov, were not subject to many performances, or their work would sound here and there on occasion.
Well, what was Schnittke's life like then in the Soviet Union? Did he earn a wage with his composing?
Luckily, as in many countries, and I guess in the United States as well, the cinema helped a lot. You must know how many composers in the 30s emigrated, went to L.A. and worked for the film industry. So many gifted composers among them, like Bernard Herrmann or Miklos Rocha, just naming a couple of them. The same thing happened somehow as well in Russia or in Soviet Union. Composers like Denisov, Alfred Schnittke, Sofia Gubaidulina earned their living by writing film music or occasionally music for theater. But the real compositions, they very often had to keep in their tables.
Well, you have a polka from Alfred Schnittke on your new album, Happy Birthday, with the Kremerata Baltica Orchestra. Let's listen to it. Polka from Alfred Schnittke, performed by my guest Gidon Kremer and his orchestra, Kremerata Baltica, from their new CD, Happy Birthday. You left the Soviet Union eventually in 1980. What kind of break was that? Was that a gradual or a dramatic one for you?
Any break, even a very soft one, was a dramatic one at that time. In fact, I did stay abroad during one of the tours, this particular tour when I brought Alfred to the West in 1977, and I demanded at the same time from the authorities to be a free man. I asked them to allow me for 2 years to follow my commitments and concerts in the West. It was a formula which some musicians like Slava Rostropovich used to articulate the no return to the native country. But at the same time, I didn't want to cut my ties with the Soviet Union and with my friends and with my audience. And that's why I enlarged my statement saying, I'd like to stay in the West, but I want to follow up also all my commitments which I have with my concert activities in the Soviet Union. For 2 years, like a miracle, I was allowed to have a passport which gave me such a privilege among most of the musicians living in Russia at that time. But after 2 years, in 1980, the authorities said, this is enough and you have to return. And then I decided not to return consciously, and I had to face another kind of punishment for about 8 years before the perestroika, in fact, started. I was not anymore considered to be a Soviet artist, to be an artist that can perform in the Soviet Union.
Did you have visiting privileges?
Yeah, I was allowed to visit, and I did visit my daughter who lived in Moscow and my friends during this year, here and there, but just as a tourist. I was never allowed to perform. Before my return in 1988, when I, for the first time, played again on a a stage in Moscow and St. Petersburg, at that time still Leningrad. And this was probably the first case of someone that left the Soviet Union for good, returned. Later, many of the Russian musicians that emigrated returned, but I was probably the only case of a Soviet musician with a Soviet passport that was not allowed to play on the Soviet stage for 8 years and then returned as a Soviet artist living abroad.
When did you first hear his work?
Falling in love with Astor Piazzolla was a very unexpected thing for me. I never thought that I would play a tango. Even I knew from my youth already what tango means.
So when you were young, you had heard tangos?
Of course, and I even tried at that time, probably this was the last time, and then I gave up, tried to dance some tangos. But Astor Piazzolla was introduced to me by a friend in Germany on a videotape, and it was striking to see him play, and his music was striking as well. Every time I went to Argentina, I visited many nightclubs, tango clubs, and heard music which was different from all the other. And this was always recognizable, that it was handwriting, the tunes of Astor Piazzolla. And so, step by step, I tried to figure out if there is something for violin and included a couple of encores into my repertoire.
Well, what did you love about it? It's very passionate. It's also very nostalgic music.
What is striking that his music is as sincere, as nostalgic, as dramatic as the music by Franz Schubert. To me, they go kind of together. Even Piazzolla never wrote symphonies and never wrote piano sonatas, but the tone of the statement is set on the same dramatic note. It is always incredibly focused and it's always incredibly powerful. I like Piazzolla for his ability to reach our souls and to speak directly to our hearts.
Well, let's play one of your Piazzolla pieces. This is Le Grand Tango from your first Piazzolla album, Omage a Piazzolla. And that's my guest, violinist Vidan Kramer, playing Astor Piazzolla's Le Grand Tango from his album Omage a Piazzolla. I love the swooping high notes you get out of your violin in this piece, and also how it moves from very passionate to a kind of tense mournfulness, and then back again to a heated tango. Is that the challenge for you in navigating the emotional arc of Piazzolla's music?
I don't think Piazzolla is about embellishment. I don't think Piazzolla can be expressed rightly, just gliding on the surface of convenient rhythms. This music can't be, in fact, performed. It has to be lived. And I always can distinguish if someone is flirting with Piazzolla as a convenient item of our commercial industry, or someone really lives the life or the heartbeat of the music of this great composer.
So what does that mean musically, to live it?
To allow oneself to be burned by it. I saw a number of artists in my life that went on stage and were burning, so to say, were not pretending to be big performers or pretending to be big virtuosos, but really were the expression itself. Such artists like Maria Callas or Jacques Brel left a mark in my understanding what a stage presence is. And among them, I can also name an artist like Leonard Bernstein, whom many described as a showman, but I have collaborated with him so much that I know that he, whatever he did, he meant seriously.
You've written three books. Your third book, Between the Worlds, is due out soon. Your second book, you had a beautiful dedication. It was dedicated to all those who are searching for quietness, because that's where the most beautiful music is born. What does that mean to you, this search for quietness?
It means search for meditation. It means listening to your inner voice and distracted by all the noises which our days surround us. We all suffer from the tendency to promote stars, from the tendency to put stars before the music, from the tendency to be easy listening or easy digesting to the buyers or listeners. We all suffer from it, and I'm trying as much as I can to follow my own tastes, my own projects, and my own visions. But it's constantly a fight. It's a fight against promoters, fight against labels, and you find collaborators, and I'm very happy to have found a number of them. But here and there, it becomes quite dramatic, this fight.
Well, I'd like to end with some more music, perhaps something that you'd suggest for us, a favorite of yours that we haven't gotten to yet.
It's hard for me to choose something, because each recording is very dear to me. But maybe we should visit the site of the beginning of Camerata Baltica, the site of Eight Seasons, which combines music by Vivaldi and Piazzolla.
Very good. Let's listen. And thank you so much, Gideon Kremer, for joining us today.
Thank you for talking to me.
Don Kramer's new CD with his Camerata Baltica Orchestra is Happy Birthday. He performs this week in Philadelphia and New York. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.